The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
All right, we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha on Twitter at Cold Omaha MN. I am your host of Midwest Swing. I'm Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. Joining me in the producer's chair today is Tom Schreier, co-founder of Cold Omaha, at TSchreier3 on Twitter. Tom, yep. What's going on today?
Not too much. We just got done with our meeting. We're trying to fill out our website, have a ton of content.
Yeah, hashtag content. I missed the meeting. I teleconferenced in, I guess. People come in on the phone as part of a chat as well. So I kept up with it on the phone. I'm kind of battling a cold, as I'm sure people can deduce from my voice. So trying to limit my exposure to human people, which in general is kind of my personal philosophy.
Dustin's calling it.
But what I'm working on, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't matter that our guest is two time zones away. He's calling in to not get sick. Right.
He would have flown in otherwise.
Yeah. So I'm kind of having like that Phoebe sexy voice episode of The Friends where she tries to have that cold.
Oh, God.
No, I don't think I want to keep that. But we'll play back the tape. We'll go back and review it to see if it sounds as good as we think it does. But not to belabor the point, on the phone line, Dustin Nosler coming at us from the West Coast. Dustin, how we doing?
Brandon, Tom, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, we really enjoyed having you on. As everyone may remember, may not remember, Dustin was on when the Brian Dozier trade hysteria was in full effect. Was our best downloaded and listened to show. Want to thank you for that, Dustin. Although, I will let you know, Mike Berardino's Hall of Fame ballot is hot on your heels for that first episode, so we might have to have an encore presentation today.
Well, you guys did a good job not spoiling his pick, so people had to download to listen to hear.
Yeah,
he selected for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, exactly. And so we went back and forth. I did a hypothetical ballot. People can go back and listen to that and hopefully give us some more listens. We appreciate that. Anybody listening to us should go to coldomaha.com/Amazon. Keeps your Amazon experience the same, but we get a little kickback so you can support our content, whether it's podcasts, videos. We got some guys doing videos and some podcast stuff down at the Senior Bowl in Mobile, Alabama right now, which is pretty exciting because you can always go back and watch that stuff and see who Luke, or in this case, Luke and Arif, I think, is Andy down there now? Or is he
just Luke and Arif.
Okay, so Luke and Arif. You can also go back and look at who they talk about, and then after they play in the NFL, you can kind of see who they liked, who turned out real well. It's a lot of fun. So I went back and looked at some of Luke's stuff from last year, and that was pretty cool. They were down on Laquon Treadwell, I might add. So it's kind of funny that he had such a bad rookie season. But we don't have Dustin on here to talk about football. We have him on here to talk about the fact that the Dodgers got their second baseman. And unless you've been hiding under a rock here in the Twin Cities, you know that it's not Brian Dozier. But in fact, it's Logan Forsythe. Dustin, before I steer you any down any particular roads as far as what I want to hear from you, what is your general reaction to this signing and trade, not signing, from a surface standpoint?
I like the move. It's he wouldn't have been my first choice. He obviously wasn't the Dodgers' first choice, or he would have been acquired a long time ago. Factoring what it cost to acquire him, I think it's a pretty good deal on the surface. Some folks may think giving up Jose De Leon for a guy who's not Brian Dozier in terms of level production over the last few years, maybe a little bit of an overpay. And, maybe on some level it is, but the Dodgers dealt from a position of strength, starting pitching, to address a gigantic hole they had at second base. And they got a top 10 second baseman in baseball. It's hard to really be too upset about that.
If it wasn't going to be Brian Dozier, what did your list look like for guys to go after, your personal list as far as who you might have liked to have seen? I know I did see some stuff about Jerks and Profar. I have been on that wagon for the Twins, too. Not that I think they necessarily have the pieces to get him, but if anybody knows what his value is right now, it might be former assistant GM Thad Levine. If he's believed to still be capable of playing shortstop, which I think he is, he's a little bit roadblocked with Elvis Andrews locked up there in Texas. So I thought that might be an option for the Twins, one of those kind of pie-in-the-sky things. But when you're looking at second base options other than Brian Dozier, and let's assume that I'm asking you this 24 hours ago before the day the trade, excuse me, happened, who was on your list of guys you were looking at?
I actually wrote an article back, I think it was either into October, into November, one of those times, about second base upgrades.
And this is at Dodgers Digest? Or Dodger Digest?
And
yeah. I think forgot to mention that that's where you write at the beginning of the show, so people need to find you there as well.
the Dodgers, Chase Utley was a free agent. You know, he's 37, probably not likely to duplicate what he did in 2016. They traded Howie Kendrick because he probably can't play second base anymore. So I looked at some options, and my 1-2-3 were Ian Kinsler, Brian Dozier, and Logan Forsythe. So, I mean, outside of those three, I didn't really see another good fit, somebody who checked all the boxes. All three of those guys checked all the boxes, some more than, you know, a little stronger than others. I think Forsythe is a nice consolation prize to missing out on Dozier, and with Ian Kinsler's no trade clause, that really complicated matters.
Did you get the sense all offseason that Jose De Leon was kind of destined to be moved for somebody or something?
It seemed like that in the last month or so. Like he was one of their best trade chips. A high value prospect, little major league time already. Didn't fare particularly well overall, but he did show some flashes of what got him to where he is right now. The Dodgers probably were not as high on De Leon as some other folks maybe. They figure, okay, we've got a ton of starting pitching. Which guys can we move to upgrade and still be okay with our depth? And they identified that guy as Jose De Leon. And, you know, it just, that's the way it goes sometimes. I mean, I tracked him. He was a 24th round pick in 2013. Didn't have a really great debut. Got a kick in the butt from former scouting director Deshaun Watson, saying he needs to get in shape because he came to spring training in 14 kind of out of shape, not taking everything super seriously. Once he did that, he took off. He's got a good fastball, plus changeup, developing breaking ball. The only thing, he had a couple of red flags with, an ankle injury, a shoulder inflammation, hasn't had a heavy workload so far. I'm not as concerned about that, but, when you look at the Dodgers, they still have 10 to 12 guys capable of taking the ball to make a start in the majors in 2017, even after trading De Leon.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, too, part of the thing that the Dodgers have to do is kind of clear some of that prospect depth, because there's just not going to be room for all of it. I think, what were they, number six, I think Tom was saying, as far as their farm system, as far as Keith Law was concerned. And, you can't have all these prospects at all the same time, because then 40-man spots become scarce and you got to start making moves you don't like to make. And so, it helps that he's major league ready in pretty much every way, shape, and form. Tampa Bay is a good fit for him in that respect, and that he's got 6 years of control as well. I think it was a good deal for both sides.
Yeah, I think Tampa has the advantage of it maybe turning out better on their end than it would on the Dodgers' end. Forsythe would have to outproduce what he's done the last two seasons for that to happen for the Dodgers. But, De Leon, he's not a surefire prospect, because there's no such thing as a pitching prospect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's a really good deal. That Tampa rotation looks like it could rack up a bunch of strikeouts really quickly. They've got a lot of good swing and miss guys. De Leon fits in there really well. And it just seems like it was the best place for him to end up.
Tom, correct me. It's the fifth best farm system, according to Keith Law of ESPN on the Insider thing. So obviously
that's after graduating Corey Seager and Julio Urias last year.
Yeah, that's what I said. We were actually talking about it before the show, and it's kind of amazing all the prospect depth they've graduated. You go a little further back, you got Jock Peterson as well. And so, yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, part of that is kind of relatable to the Twins, too, having graduated Miguel Sano and Byron Buxton, and I think Barrios probably as well, is that to still have a system that high when some of your top guys clear out is quite frankly amazing. But it's also obvious why that was a really good negotiating fit for the Twins. And, what's your takeaway with the fact that the deal didn't get done with the Twins? Because, frankly, there are a lot of Twins fans that wish the Twins would have taken the pitching prospect and ran. Personally, I just don't think that De Leon is worth Dozier. And there's a lot of upset people on the Twins side of things thinking you got to get young pitching. And it's like, well, when you go into a negotiation with the mantra at any cost, you are kind of inviting yourself to be exploited. And I think that Thad Levine deserves credit, but I think even more so, Derek Falvey deserves credit for having a good poker face and a stiff upper lip in his first serious trade negotiations as an executive.
Yeah, the Twins were well within their right to want more than Jose De Leon. Brian Dozier is really, really good player. He's definitely better than Logan Forsythe. Maybe not two or three times better than Logan Forsythe, but he's clearly the superior player. And so they should have been expecting more than Jose De Leon. I'm not saying they should have held out for guys like Cody Bellinger, Yadier Alvarez, Walker Buehler. But they could have gotten De Leon and maybe a lower level lottery ticket or two that may have made it worth their while. But at the same time, the Twins, while they may not contend for a playoff spot this season, they're not absolutely forced to trade Dozier because they still have 2 years of control. They could trade him somewhere else. They could trade him at the trade deadline and still probably get a nice return as long as he performs. You know, he doesn't have to be on the 42 home run pace that he had last season, but if he's performing relatively well, he's still going to be a valuable commodity come July 31st.
Well, and I liken it to like a $5 bill in a five-year-old's pocket. Just because you feel obligated to spend it doesn't mean you're forced to spend it. And Dozier as an asset, you know, and it's funny how many people say, well, you didn't trade him at the peak of his value. Well, if the peak of his value in the marketplace right now is Jose De Leon, and that's only going to go down from there, then he provides more value than that to the Twins. And it's, I guess, in a nutshell to me, like the MVP debate, how valuable can a guy be on a bad team? Well, Mike Trout was still very, very valuable, even though the Angels didn't play very well as a team last year. And so there is value in Brian Dozier having two more seasons with the Twins. They can hit him with a qualifying offer. And then, if they need to, it all depends on how he evolves. Keep in mind, too, he's about to turn 30 years old. And so, you know, if this is the peak of Dozier's value, then it was never worth trading him in the first place. And I think that's where people are having the disconnect is it's not a video game deal where, you know, a guy's peak at his value and you just submit his name and then the offers pour in. If the offers aren't there that are to your liking, you just got to sit it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, this was the first move of this new regime in Minnesota, potential move. And, you know, some say they may have been, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, they may have bungled it, let's just say, this whole situation. I don't agree with that at all. They were well within the right to want more than what the Dodgers were offering. And, you know, it comes down to negotiating, and the Dodgers had other options, whereas the Twins didn't have other options in terms of other teams interested in Brian Dozier right now at the price they wanted to move him. So, I mean, naturally, it's going to fall apart like that when neither side will budge. And then the Dodgers moved on to another option where they felt comfortable giving up Jose De Leon for Logan Forsythe instead of Jose De Leon plus for Brian Dozier. It's not all bad for the Twins. Dozier's probably their best player, correct?
As of right now, he is. Yeah.
I mean, I know Joe Mauer's falling off a bit, and Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano haven't taken off quite yet. So
there's no question it's him and then everybody else in terms of current production and value.
Yeah, and you know, if you're trading your best player who's coming off a near 6-1 season, you want to get some good value for it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't getting what they wanted. They weren't getting close to what they wanted. So they like you said, they held firm. They did not give in. The Dodgers didn't want to budge off of their offer, so they moved on. I mean, that happens so much behind the scenes that the public probably never even hears about.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually kind of surprising these negotiations were as public as they were, considering the Dodgers are really tight-lipped with the information that leaks out.
And your cohort, Chad Moriyama, had to kind of fend off, it seemed like, some people that were nonplussed from as far as Dodgers fans with the return on this trade. I think part of it, too, is that Forsythe is not exactly a household name. And again, not due to his production, but the fact that, keep in mind, this guy for all Dodgers fans remember, would be his Padres days, seeing him in the National League West. You know, not a particularly exciting player. Did have one nice year, but was never a full-time guy. And then you play in relative anonymity in Tampa Bay, I think. You know, obviously Evan Longoria, everybody knows about him, but even he might not be as appreciated as he might be if he played elsewhere. What was your take on how some of the folks reacted to this as, you know, oh, this guy, I've never heard of this guy, or he's not particularly good? Or did you think there was a better reaction than that and I might have missed it?
No, you're right. I mean, the fact he didn't hit 42 home runs is what stands out, because the Dodgers were reportedly close to acquiring a guy who just hit 42 home runs. So the fact that Forsythe didn't, you know, it's all automatically going to be, well, this guy's not any good. Why did we give up Jose De Leon? Why did you? The funniest one is, and I've seen it multiple times, people are calling this the next Pedro Martinez for Delino Shields deal, which is just utterly insane.
Yeah,
because Jose De Leon, and it's no slight and no disrespect to him, he is not the next Pedro Martinez. And
well, he's not a Hall of Famer, most likely.
Yeah, I actually recorded an episode of my podcast earlier, and I said I would quit blogging if Jose De Leon became a Hall of Fame Pedro Martinez type guy.
Well, that sounds like Pedro me with Danny Santana when he was coming off a .405 batting average on balls in play, and I staked my reputation on it, and so far so good.
you know, those are generational type players, and the only reason why Dodger fans are some Dodger fans would equate to that because it's a starting pitching prospect who for a second baseman. That's really the only tie. So, you know, the casual fan, and not to sound elitist or anything, but they're like you said, they're not going to be as amped for the deal because Forsythe is not a well-known name, but he is a top 10 second baseman in baseball. He's in the top 10 out of, you got 30 teams. You can only have 30 starting second basemen, and Forsythe is one of the 10 best. I mean, it's hard to really be upset with that.
So what does he do differently than Dozier? What does he do better? What do they do a lot alike? If you were to break down him versus Dozier, you know, what does it look like for you?
Dozier, obviously, I mean, Dozier has the edge on power. He's one of the best power hitting infielders in the game. Whether people want to believe it or not, the numbers back it up. Dozier's also a better defender than Forsythe. Forsythe has better on-base skills, better contact skills, I think. You know, Dozier's probably faster as well, and a better base runner. But, you know, Forsythe is kind of a real light version of Brian Dozier. He's got some pop. He's got some on-base ability. He does have a little swing and miss. But he doesn't rely solely on BABIP. He makes good contact. He just does a lot of things really well. He's not standout in any one area. He's a solid, consistent player, and that's, you know, those guys are quite valuable.
What I like, excuse me, I got a cough here. What I like is that they're not entirely dissimilar at the foundation. Two Southern guys. Dozier was a Southern Miss guy, and Forsythe was University of Arkansas. Came up playing other than second base. A lot of guys move over from the middle infield. In fact, Dozier, I believe, played shortstop at Southern Miss. Forsythe has played all over, which is kind of a hallmark of not only the Padres, but, of course, the Rays did settle in at second base this year. Forsythe, obviously, first-round pick and had a little more prestige, a little better minor league career, but had kind of faltered with the Padres, really had a rough season before he was flipped to the Rays. And so it's been funny to see these guys come out of nowhere. So it's kind of funny how similar backstories, but at the same time a little bit different, can still end up being largely similar players.
Yeah, and, you know, you can have a first-round pick with the pedigree and the prestige, but there are going to be the later-round draft picks who end up being better players. It just happened. Not every first-round pick is a for-sure stud player at the MLB level. But, yeah, they are kind of based in kind of the same, like you said, the same the same kind of...
Like format or cut from the same mold?
And Forsythe, actually, I saw an article, this was from a few years ago, so it may not still be true, but he said he actually enjoyed playing third base more than second base.
Oh, really?
He has taken to second base since turning pro and reaching the majors. And his bat play is a lot better at second base anyway. Yeah, I mean, he's not, let's say he's not Brian Dozier with the glove, but he's going to be solidly average.
So Fangraphs, a place that obviously is near and dear to both of our hearts, or at least is in our past, wrote that the Dodgers acquired Brian Dozier basically. Now, I kind of bristle at that. Now, I think Forsyth looks like the pre-breakout Brian Dozier, maybe a little more thunder in his bat from a slugging percentage standpoint and a little better on-base skills, but still not – I don't really buy that comparison either, because that's – to me, that intentionally says, you know what, Dozier's 2016 was entirely a fluke. Now, if he – I believe if Dozier settles in somewhere between 2015 and 2016, that's pretty likely. It still means that he could have adjusted to some point where he can retain and maintain some of that power. But I don't buy that they're the same player. And I know that wasn't the exact point, but it was, well, they basically got Brian Dozier. I still feel like that's just a little bit off kilter.
I think what Dozier has done over the last three seasons is about what you can expect Forsyth to max out at.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Dozier he's had that 42 home run season. I don't think he's terribly likely to repeat it, but he's going to get you 20, 25 home runs. Whereas Forsyth, he did come off a 20 home run season, and he missed 4 weeks with an injury, but I don't see him getting to 30. I don't expect him to get to 25. I mean, if he's in the 15 to 20 range, I think that's plenty good, because he's also going to be on base and in decent defense. So, I mean, it was a little, kind of had to do some twisting and turning to make that article work. And Jeff Sullivan's one of the best baseball writers out there. And
mm-hmm, absolutely.
I read everything he writes. And it's an interesting way to look at it. But, yeah, like you said, it does kind of say Brian Dozier's 2016 was a complete fluke. And the numbers just don't back up that it was a complete fluke. Yeah, he hit a ton of home runs. He got really hot in the second half. But I don't think – I think he's a little – better than what Sullivan's giving credit for.
I think that the most underappreciated, or one of the most underappreciated slash lines, is what Forsyth brings, like a 260, 330, 340 on base, and then a 430, 440 slugging. You know, if a guy like that can play defense at up the middle, even if it's just capable, steal a couple bases, I don't think fans appreciate the level above replacement that is, and just that. Yeah, that's a pretty solid player.
Yeah, and in his last two seasons, he's 20% better or 19% better than league average via weighted runs created plus. I mean, that's not anything to scoff at.
Yeah,
Logan Forsyth is a really good baseball player. Brian Dozier is a better baseball player, but Logan Forsyth is really good. And who knows? Maybe he will break out. Mm-hmm. Maybe he will pop 30 and make the Dodgers look like geniuses for making this move instead of acquiring, paying what it costs to acquire Brian Dozier. Who knows? I'm not going to bet on it, but I think for what the Dodgers gave up and what Logan Forsyth did, I think it's actually a really good fit.
Yeah, I got 119 for weighted runs created plus for the last 2 years for Forsyth. Dozier's previous two, I think, were 109, but obviously much better this year. So, yeah, it's not hard to squint and see some similarities, but at the same time, too, you do have to diminish his 2016 considerably. As far as the offseason for the Dodgers, before we let you go, do you think the Dodgers are done making significant moves at this point?
I don't think there's going to be anything major. I mean, people keep thinking maybe they'll do something for left field, but they've got a lot of outfielders.
They really do.
Yeah, I mean...
What does the starting outfield look like right now, hypothetically?
Well, Jack Peterson in center field, for sure. That's unquestioned.
And then it's kind of everybody else kind of figure it out, right?
Basically, I think Yasiel Puig should be in right field without question. That's me, though. And we talked about this earlier on my podcast, that he might need to earn it a little bit more than just have it given to him, because that has been kind of the thing with him, is the effort putting in, the effort before the games, after the, in practice, batting cages, stuff like that. He needs to kind of get back to doing that like he was early in the season. But if he does that, you've got two mid-20s guys in center field and right field who are plenty good defensively, especially Puig, plenty really good offensively. That leaves a a veritable who's who in left field. Andre Ethier, Andrew Tolles, Trace Thompson when he's healthy, Enrique Hernandez, if he remembers how to hit left-handers.
But basically, you can play the hot hand out there, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're going to play the matchup there. I mean, Andre Ethier, he may not, even at the end of last season, he wasn't fully recovered from the broken leg he had in spring training. He still had pain in it when he was playing. So if he has pain in it still at the beginning of this season or in spring training, you're probably not going to be counting on him for 450 plate appearances. So you're going to have to make that up somewhere with guys like Tolles and Thompson and Van Slyke. But you'll definitely play the platoon in terms of Van Slyke. He murders lefties, at least he has in the past. Darren Ruffin has been pretty good at that. I don't know if he's going to make the opening day roster because I think he's out of options. But and you've got Trace Thompson coming off the back injury. And Andrew Tolles, we still don't know exactly what Tolles is. Mm-hmm. He had a pretty decent stretch in the majors, you know, a few weeks worth of solid production in the playoffs. But, you know, is that the real guy or is he closer to what he was before 2016? I mean, that just remains to be seen. So to, in a long-winded way to answer your question, I don't think there'd be too many moving parts to try to upgrade left field with a guy like Ryan Braun or something like that, right. Somebody who's been rumored like that. Other than that, maybe a reliever and upgrade on the fringes, and the offseason for Dodgers is probably good.
So what's your grade for their offseason?
Oh, I give it an A. They retain their three big free agents, which I don't think anybody, even the biggest homer Dodger fan, thought was going to happen. I thought at best they'd get two of Kenley Jansen, Justin Turner, and Rich Hill back. Instead, they retained all three. They added Forsyth. They cleared some money by trading Howie Kendrick and Carlos Ruiz, and that also opens up Austin Barnes to be the true backup catcher, mm-hmm. which should be an improvement overall. It's hard not to give it an A. I mean, some people will say, oh, it's the same team, basically the same team we brought back last year outside of Forsyth. Well, you're also going to get, hopefully, you know, 20 more starts out of, or 20, 25 more starts out of Rich Hill and Julio Urias, which is just going to up that production, the rotation even more. And if you have a healthy Clayton Kershaw,
I was just about to say that,
miss any starts, you got the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah, you can't complain about that. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. This has been Dustin Nosler, Dodger Digest. We really appreciate you coming on.
Anytime, guys. Thanks
thank
for having
you.
Me.
Thank you so much. Yeah, Tom, so I really appreciate having him on. He does a great job.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great.
And so one thing I want to touch on before we wrap up the entire show, a couple things. First of all, I've been battling people about Jason Castro on Twitter. You know, people are really upset that that's like the only big move the Twins have made this offseason. I think people are underrating what a guy like Castro can do to a pitching staff, like of the value he can have. And I think I see what the vision is here, and it's this. If you're a team in flux or transition, you don't really know what your identity is, it doesn't really make sense to do a lot of moves pitching-wise. What Castro will enable this brain trust to do is to spend this next year finding out what they truly have in these guys. Kyle Gibson be a number three starter, 3.80 ERA, 60% ground ball rate?
You would hope so.
7 strikeouts per 9, even if it's 3 walks per 9. Can Trevor May, with a better catcher, better framer, better game caller, better everything defensively, except maybe blocker, because that's what Suzuki was good at. By the way, Suzuki signed with the Atlanta Braves, if people haven't seen. I think it was $1.5 million. So good to see the axe bat going down to do the tomahawk chop, I guess. I think people are underrating, though, yeah, what Castro can bring to a staff that I think is more talented than they showed.
You know, if it works out this year, I would say Hughes and Irvin are 1A, 1B, right? But not really
assuming
aces.
Everyone's healthy and good.
Yeah.
Unless Barrios breaks out or Gonsalves comes up and just sets the world on fire.
Because
yeah.
That's the way I see it. You have two, like, non-aces, but, like, semi-aces at the top. That's assuming.
But you need to see what they are capable of with your best option behind the plate. A good defensive catcher can be the foundation for whatever your pitching staff is going to be. Pittsburgh did it twice, not only with Russell Martin, but with Francisco Cervelli, where they had a good pitching staff in place, but it wasn't quite clicking. that I wanted the Twins to sign Russell Martin when he became a free agent. He signed for, I think, 5 years and like $82 million with the Blue Jays. I would have given him that. When you can reshape your pitching department around a catcher, and you know, I know the concept is the Twins need better pitching, but there's more than one way to skin a cat.
So, and that's the way I'm looking at it is you have, if you have those two at the top, Gibson, May, and
Santiago
then
probably
Santiago, yeah. and you hope Berrios displaces Santiago.
Berrios forces your hand. Someone's going to get hurt. Someone's going to get traded. Someone's going to get cut. It's bound to happen. You can never have enough pitching. I think people say that as a cliche, but it is rooted in fact.
Yeah, and the way I see it, there's a conceivable rotation that's serviceable, if not good, this year. And
point, there's no reason they should be the worst rotation ERA again. They should be better than that.
And to your point, so Castro should bring out the best in them because he's a pitch framer and he has a lot of major league experience in the prime of his career.
Well, keep in mind, too, he was the catcher for Dallas Keuchel becoming a Cy Young winner out of relative obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he did catch Keuchel last year. Keuchel had kind of a rough year. Colin McHugh kind of came out of nowhere. You know, they've had guys like Lance McCullers, good pitcher, but they've had guys come out of nowhere. It would be interesting to see what the effect was of Castro to turn those guys into. Now, McHugh, he throws high fastballs. It just works for him. Keuchel's got good ground ball stuff. Maybe Gibson. I don't think Gibson quite has the stuff Keuchel does, although I think Keuchel's stuff was diminished a bit this last year. I still think, though, it makes sense foundationally, especially since I think it's going to be a year of transition for Falvey, Levine as well. It's two guys coming from completely separate sides of the track, separate organizations. They're spending a year evaluating Paul Molitor. They're going to spend a year
all the innards, basically.
Yep, all the carryover staff. It makes sense to do that with the players, too. And yep, I believe Thad Levine when he says this is not a 103-loss team on talent alone. And that's what probably is what tripped my trigger in the first place to write the article that I wrote last week, that this is an 80-win team talent-wise. I believe Thad Levine when he says that he's not talking out of both sides of his mouth. It is a talented team compared to how many games they lost.
And
last year
was about a 74-win team, I think. Somewhere between
72-75, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other component here is that John Ryan Murphy, they traded Aaron Hicks, who, granted, it was Terry Ryan, not the current regime, but Terry Ryan thought very highly of first round pick, showed kind of the skills and maybe just not put it all together.
Or the baseball IQ.
Right. Or just the willingness to know who the pitcher was that day. But John Ryan Murphy seems like a good foil for Castro. He's a good defensive.
Well, so yeah, great framer, right-handed bat. Castro doesn't hit lefties. Whether it's Garver, like we said last week, whether it's Garver, Murphy, Jimenez, they should have a capable foil for Castro or a platoon partner.
And that person also should bring out the best in the rotation,
be a drop-off, right.
So this is the difference between this regime and Terry Ryan. Terry Ryan did a lot of good things, but when you had Byung-Ho Park coming in and you had Mauraki playing first base, you have Vargas, you have Sano, who's probably a DH at the end of the day, like as he gets older.
Yeah.
You have, I'm trying to think of who else, you know, Trevor Plouffe probably played some first.
It was a logjam like, where a logjam wasn't necessary.
Right, and then there was this weird, like, why are you putting a 275-pound man out in the outfield? And, you know.
It kind of belabored the point, like, the loyalty to Plouffe, which I understand from a clubhouse standpoint, one of the best clubhouse guys, coming off a fairly good season, hadn't he, like, broke his wrist or something to end last year?
Well, I think he broke his wrist, but he also had a concussion, and he's had a lot of ribs.
Yeah, so he'd had the fine season. And you know, maybe there were no offers, but at the same time, too, like that blind loyalty to it's not blind loyalty. I guess I can't say it's blind loyalty. They made the Plouffe situation more than it needed to be. When you're in that chair, you're required to make difficult decisions. And if biting the bullet and trading Trevor Plouffe for less than he was worth
could have made
the team better, or at least made the team better equipped for the future because you find out what you have in Miguel Sano at third, then maybe that's what should have been done. Now, like I said in the article, you have to keep in mind, though, that would have been putting a lot on Miguel Sano, who was under a year removed from Tommy John surgery and recovery and had only played a handful of innings at third base to end the 2015 season. So to keep Plouffe as a safety net made sense, you didn't have any backup plans. You know, maybe if you trade Plouffe, Eduardo Escobar is your third base safety net. Maybe then Danny Santana is your shortstop safety net. And maybe that's not enough for a team coming off 83 wins who, in the press box at Nationals Park for that preseason set, Terry Ryan said, you know, I feel like we're a postseason caliber team. Maybe that wasn't enough justification to move Trevor Plouffe for sub value.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe not making that mistake is what led to the avalanche of additional mistakes. And like I said, I don't know that moving Miguel Sano to right field alone cost Terry Ryan his job.
Oh,
but I think that was the snowball that gained additional size as the season rolled on, and eventually was like, man, you know, shoehorning him in right field, like that's the kind of decision that gets guys fired.
And the potential, as I've said, and I don't want to belabor this point, but a fly ball out to right center could potentially literally take out your two best prospects. Like, those two collided.
We saw it happen when Buxton collided with...
It's a kid from Minnesota.
Yeah, the... why is his name escaping me?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Kwasnicka.
Right.
Mike Kwasnicka, who I think plays for the Saints now, doesn't he?
Yeah, or played for him.
Yeah, and so... is one of those. Well, if you prepare for a rainy day, you're going to live only rainy days.
Yeah.
So there is that, but if that's a legit Murray, keep in mind, Nunez and Sano collided. That's where that Joe Mauer throw from short
right
to third base
that Matt Trueblood wrote about.
Matt Trueblood, one of our favorite guests, wrote about that majestic Joe Mauer throw where for that moment you saw peak Joe Mauer. I'm getting chills. Like, I don't know if you can see it because I'm wearing a jacket.
Yeah.
I'm getting chills thinking about that throw. But that was the kind of play you just are like, okay, this is Miguel Sano, probably the best, most talented player on the team. That could have been Brian Dozier for all we know, but it was Eduardo Nunez. That's their all-star. That was their best first half player last year.
Right.
I mean, that's a logical leap you're making. It makes sense to me.
So I still look in the outfield because if you really look up and down the roster, you see a pitching rotation and backups there. You see relievers and people who could come up and be relievers on the major
league
team.
There's no gaping hole where you're like, man, the Twins are really hurting here.
The only question I have is the outfield, because I think Buxton starts at center, probably.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
I think Kepler's going to be an everyday player. I really believe. Just
I think he should play left field, though. I do think he should play left field.
And then the other corner spot is still a concern.
Well, Eddie Rosario has been a nightmare.
I mean, he's just up and down. And
yeah. The difference between him becoming an everyday regular is plate discipline, but there's just no proof that it's in there.
And Grossman, I think, is just a bad defensive player that...
I don't think he's as bad as he showed, though. I don't think he's as bad as he showed. I think he's
his
capable.
Bat's good.
Yeah, and when he hits righties, or lefties, excuse me, as a righty... you know, he does a fine job. You know, lefties, he wasn't dead, but at the same time, there's no guarantee he's going to repeat that.
So, and this is just a pet theory I've had, because Mauer's always the oven in the room. I wonder, given that you have a lot of first base options, and if you have a winning team, if Molitor maybe sits down with him and says, let's just try you in the outfield. Because you imagine that arm in the outfield, and he's got to be fast enough. I understand he can't collide with the wall, but maybe there's just a gentleman's agreement that, like, if it's a 50-50 ball, don't ruin your career over it. You know what I mean? Like, kind of a...
I wish I had the confidence you do that they would do that, because then they could go sign Chris Carter. They could pencil
just play
in Kenny Vargas
more.
Well, I don't know about Kenny Vargas as a first baseman. He did make strides.
But he can be at DH and he can move.
He did.
Byung-ho Park
well,
to first.
And you just, I think Byung-ho Park's gonna go AAA. I do.
I know. I'm just saying at some point
this
season.
It clears a logjam, and you know, then you have Eddie Rosario as your fourth outfielder, backing up at all three spots, but pushing guys for playing time.
Yeah,
it's not the worst theory I've ever heard.
I mean, I understand the thought process that my argument all along has been, Joe Mauer, at the moment he signed that contract, was a $23 million a year player that probably...
He was probably a $30 million a year player at that point.
Who probably, between back issues, it seems like maybe lingering leg issues, and then a concussion, which accelerated everything, turned him from a Hall of Fame caliber catcher to a pedestrian first baseman literally overnight.
Yep.
I feel like people in Minnesota would feel differently about Joe Mauer if he's part of a winning formula. If you see plays like that, that literally inspired Matt Trueblood, who lives here but is a Cubs fan,
he doesn't have much interest in the Twins outside of that's on the TV.
Right. And so my thought there is, if you see him as part of the winning formula, a guy who is a, you know, quarterback at Creighton Durham Hall, could have played at Florida State, was an elite athlete as a catcher coming up and for many years with the Twins, you would think he's quick enough to get to many fly balls. And again, I think there's just, this is something where if Paul Molitor really wants to go from kind of the hometown hero, the good story of coming back, the job he always wanted, to I want to be in the Joe Maddon League, the Tito League, the it's not just X's and O's. It's being able to sit down to with a player and saying, look, if you do this, this is best for you. This is going to make the fans.
It's what's best for business.
And look, you can't ask a player to do that in a losing season, because I think Maurer goes, guys, you had to meet me halfway here. You know what I mean? Like, he could honestly say for the first couple of years of his career, I'm a 330 hitting catcher, and you have a Triple A team around me, right?
Right.
If that.
Well, especially in their down years,
Right, the Luke Hughes and the – not to pick on him
the last few years.
But I think if you're winning, I think you just say, Joe, you got to do this, because – if there's any chance that we're going to retain you beyond your contract here, or even if just next year, which I really think if Maurer has another season where he struggles, and I think, you know, you got to go to management if you're following Levine, go, you got to eat like 10 million plus here and we got to move him.
Well, I don't think he would stay on as an albatross. I know people argue that he already is one. It wouldn't stun me if he retired after next year.
Yeah. So regardless of what it is, but especially because Joe Maurer, in the same sense that, and not to talk too much about hockey, but a Zach Parise you would think would be part of the front office and part of the Wild organization pretty much throughout his lifetime.
Oh, yeah, he'll get a legacy contract.
If Joe Maurer, if he doesn't have one already.
Right. Joe Smith style, under the table.
If Joe Maurer wants to be like a Torrey Hunter, Michael Kadire, LaTroy Hawkins, all those guys you see floating around the clubhouse, I think he goes, look, this team won 83 games 2 years ago, probably should have won about 70 to 74 last year.
Well, it boils down to, do you want to be good again while you're still a Twin?
And do you want people to always see you as, you know, because this is the problem with Gardenhire too. They're going to focus on what he was at the end of his managing tenure rather than the guy who was always the runner-up.
Yeah, the recency bias.
Right. And so, because I just go, if Maurer could play right field, and you don't have him really cruising into that wall, because it's not like he's going to make the Spider-Man catch like a Ben Revere or something.
Or a young Torrey Hunter.
Right. I think if you play him in right, because you said you think Kepler should be
I don't think
in
Kepler's
left.
Arm is consistently strong enough to play right field full-time.
Where
I just don't.
Maurer's is, right?
Probably is,
It's got to be.
It's got to be.
And that way you have, in the DH spot, and you probably still rotate Maurer through at first and DH every once in a while, but at those spots, I think then you rotate a Kenny Vargas, a Byung-Ho Park. I mean, who else do they have that they, you know, Miguel Sano, right? And then the question is, then really the biggest issue is, aside from your pitching staff, the left side of your infield, where who's shortstop, because Polanco probably can't play there, and who is the third baseman?
Yeah, you can find out, you know, if you're going to be so-so, you can't afford to find out with Polanco and Sano this year. But it's, one thing before we go to a friend of mine, Grant Spears on Twitter, had tweeted about how Twins fans, and I think we all, for the most part, were at least enthused about the Denard Span deal for Alex Meyer when it went down. But then the last 3 years, fans have basically been, boo, boo, that trade was terrible.
Yeah, because he was bad.
But now then those same people are, well, why didn't the Twins trade Dozier for De Leo? It's like, that's a very
similar deal.
And what happens is if...
Because Span, to remind people, was under a very team-friendly contract.
I think it was 3 years instead of two, though.
Yeah, something like that.
The problem is, the constant refrain from those people is young pitching, young pitching, young pitching. Well, what's the most volatile commodity in the game today? Young pitching.
Right.
Young pitching gets hurt. Young pitching falters as it moves up.
I mean, that literally, to use the Twins examples, Jose Berrios, Trevor May.
Well, Cole Stewart was the fourth overall pick.
Right. Trevor May,
He's
Cole Stewart.
He's stalled out at Double A right now.
Alex Meyer.
Oh, any other first-round pick since Joe Maurer that they've used on pitchers?
Yeah.
Carlos Gutierrez, Shooter Hunt.
I forgot about that guy.
Alex Wimmers, Kyle Gibson.
Wimmers
none of those
great,
guys
Wimmers
became
great.
Who they were supposed to become.
Although I think Gibson still...
He's
maybe
fine.
I
like Kyle Gibson. I think he can be fine. But the fact of the matter is, young, when you take that narrow of a focus, you're basically saying young pitching, and then the implied is at any cost. You are invite, like I said to Dustin, you are inviting yourself to be exploited when you only take one path. And the problem is, now this anonymous scout said that he sees De Leon as perhaps a third or fourth starter with plenty of strikeouts, but mostly on deception, not as much on stuff.
Yeah.
John Manuel said, it's more like a second or third starter, he thought. Now, those anonymous scouts will always say goofy stuff. It's the same deal. There was an anonymous scout that thinks Logan Forsythe is better than Brian Dozier, which is an extremely hot take. I just don't see that. What I'm saying is how people can, as revisionists, like the Span for Meyer deal and then hate it after you see that Alex Meyer never put it together here, but still advocate for another one is like, At what point do you learn from your views?
This is just as a media person. I always view a transaction or a signing at the time it was done, right? So I actually look at the Span deal and go, I understand why it was done, but it didn't pan out.
Well, I never understood why they didn't get more pieces. My contention was...
Oh, and he would have been great for Aaron Hicks. You know what I mean? There's just
Beyond that, I thought they would get, you know, Steve Lombardozzi Jr., whose dad really famously feuded with Dan Gladden at the end of his tenure in the Twin Cities. I just thought that made, you know, there was the other deal that there was talked about was like Lombardozzi and Drew Storen, which would have been a nightmare trade because the Twins didn't need a closer when they stunk anyway. It just would have been stupid. But the narrow focus of that trade, and I'm not saying that Terry Ryan, who I have more respect for than probably any other baseball executive, when you watch baseball growing up, you never believe that those people could know your name and respect you and treat you the way Terry Ryan treats me, treats you. It's very humbling.
The guy who vacuums the carpet, right?
Very humbling experience, and so maybe that's clouding my vision a little bit about Terry Ryan, but I don't know that he went into that trade with the narrow focus of young pitching, but that's the kind of trade that can happen if you have that narrow focus. You can't focus on young pitching. You can draft young pitching. You can sign minor league free agent pitching.
It's not just young pitching. I think the Ben Revere move was more get Vance Worley and Trevor May is like looked a little bit more like a bonus, a fourth round pick.
Well, keep in mind too, Ben Revere's ceiling, if he never ever hit for power, which was clear he was not going to.
Squirt gun arm.
Yeah, there's a significantly stunted ceiling for a player like that. That was a great trade. Now,
Vance Worley didn't pan out, but Trevor May was your...
Trevor May has been fine. Trevor May is one of my guys. But to make that move, again, was it focusing on young pitching? Well, if that was young pitching, only one of those three guys panned out, and Trevor May is still fighting for a rotation spot. It's the year 2017. That trade was it between 2011 and 12 or 12 and 13?
Okay.
It was 12 and 13 because Worley started opening day 2013 against Verlander.
Right, with the
so it was after 2012. We are on year number 13, 14, 15, 16. This will be year number 5 of Trevor May in this organization, and he's still fighting for a... That's why you can't focus on young pitching. You need to do moves that make your team better, that move the needle.
Yep.
Selling low on Brian Dozier.
They should have young pitching in the system. Barrios should count.
Romero, all those guys.
Cole Stewart, Gonzalez.
Everyone says, well, you didn't sell when his value was the highest. When his value is the highest, it's still this low? Like, that's such a convoluted construct.
Also, think about that locker room. Among active players, you have Maurer, who's more a lead by example, not a rah-rah.
Perkins is the same way.
And it's going to be tough for him. Perkins is a little more a talker, though.
But it's going to be tough if he hasn't played in a year to be that kind of a leader. And if he can't play, Phil Hughes coming off a year where he missed time.
Took Plouffe out. And so
Brian Santana, I'm sure some language gap there.
I think with the Dominican players, he's actually a leader.
Oh, I think he's great. Yeah. They absolutely adore Irvin Santana.
Oh, and he's just funny. He's just a goofy dude. But,
yeah. I love how him and Mike Berardino go back and forth this whole
league. It is funny.
It's really good to watch.
But Dozier's kind of not only your most likable player right now, probably your best leader.
Keep in mind, too, no more Trevor Plouffe, no more Kurt Suzuki. Corner locker Suzuki, Plouffe was one of the post-game guys that you could talk to.
Yeah.
Still, you know, he was super sensitive as a young player. He got better.
Still,
there were still some times where you could strike a chord with him. And the odds of him hearing this or anybody that matters to him hearing this and relaying it to him are very minimal. I thought Trevor Plouffe had turned into a wonderful clubhouse citizen. I want to emphasize that. It's just that there were things you could say that would strike a chord.
He was on and off with me, and I was
And you know, I get it, though. People are people. They're going to have their feelings and views. But for me, it was just like that's another loss in that clubhouse. And so they do, from some standpoint, Dozier in the clubhouse community and on the field, first and foremost on the field, that's three things that he affects very heavily that they have to keep in mind.
Yeah, so I'm fine with them not trading Dozier. I understand this looks like the same regime where they don't do much, but you're right. I look at this year as kind of an audit, and I think they're just looking up and down the organization, the guys on the field, the scouting staff, the amateur scout, you know, drafting guys, the actual coaching staff, the minor leagues, they're looking at everything and going, they trimmed some fat already, and then they're probably going to go next year and trim some more.
It'll be transitional, just like any other thing is. Yeah. For a good, healthy organization, cut and run.
But they didn't Wile E. Coyote and go, boom, right? Because they realized, like, look, Buxton and Sano already in the major leagues. Bauer's on a big contract. You have Dozier. You have Hughes, who should be good. Santana should be good. Gibson, who should be good. A better catching staff. You know what I mean? They have pieces there, so they couldn't just Wile E. Coyote the whole thing.
They deserve 3 to 5 years to show what their vision is, too.
Yeah.
And that vision will become clearer probably a year from now.
It's just not Tom Thibodeau with, you know, 3 21-year-old players and kind of the future ahead of them, right? The Twins, they should win 80 games, as you said. They really should be a good team next year because they have 5 years to become a contender. They don't have 5 years to become a winning team again. You know, that's the time frame they got.
Tom, that's all I've got. I want to thank people for joining us. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.